It's a very serious attack surface that we have to work hard on, but to actually...
You said hard on. And welcome to this, the last full episode of Risky Business for 2011. My name is Patrick Gray. This is episode 222, our 42nd consecutive episode of the year. I don't think we've had a break at all. Normally we do 44 full episodes, but we've only had three sponsors all year. And, you know, I've taken on some other work that I'm keen to get through before Christmas. So this is basically it for the full show until February next year. It's possible we're going to publish a couple of conference talks, or maybe Adam and I will do a couple of news-only versions of the show. But this is it for Risky Business proper for the year. This week's show is brought to you by Astaro, the network security division of Sophos. Astaro has sponsored Risky Business all through 2011, so big thanks to them. And soon we'll be joined by Astaro product manager Angelo Comizetto a bit later on in the show for this week's sponsor interview. Now, I thought we'd have a bit of fun in this week's feature interview for the last feature interview of the year. It's an interview with Edith Cowan University's Peter Hannay about a presentation he did at RuxCon last year in 2010. And it's all about turning Amazon's Kindle into a completely free internet access device that works all over the world. So no subscriber fees, but you get 3G access anywhere that AT&T or Sprint have a roaming agreement, which is a pretty cool trick if you've checked data roaming charges lately. He'll tell you how you can hack your Kindle to use as a completely free USB internet access device pretty much anywhere in the world. Woot woot, SSH everywhere. That's coming up soon, but before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we start this week's news with scandal, scandal, scandal. We've covered it over the last couple of weeks, this Carrier IQ software, which was apparently loaded onto many Android devices. A researcher had a bit of a look at it, labelled it a rootkit, was threatened by the company that made it. They said, take that back, and then they dropped it. And he's actually extended his research a bit and found that this software installed on millions and millions of handsets is really sinister.
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. We covered it briefly last week in terms of the company's, you know, kind of legal response and then the subsequent withdrawal of the cease and desist letter they sent this guy. But I did a bit of reading this morning about this, because it's kind of interesting. There has been the research that's come out over the last few days suggesting that this software is very widely installed across Androids and indeed other platforms, it seems. And so I went and had a look around, and I went and watched the original, like, the video that this guy did in which he demonstrates the ability of this Carrier IQ software to record keystrokes and record all the URLs you visit in your browser, record the numbers that you're dialing on your phone. And it's I'm a bit curious about this, because the video that he demonstrates, like, he shows that it is collecting the information, but there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that it's actually sending it off, right? I mean, it's getting, you know, into process messaging from the user interface of the phone that you've pressed buttons, but it's not, there's no evidence that it's actually sending it. And then Dan Rosenberg, who's a very well-respected Linux kernel, you know, vulnerability security researcher who's done a lot of work on the Android platform, posted on his Twitter feed recently that he's actually reversed the binary himself, and he sees, once again, no evidence that it actually uses this information, that it actually sends it anywhere. And that, combined with the response from the Carrier IQ themselves, really does begin to make me wonder to what extent this is all just kind of turned into a bit, a bit of a hysterical sort of, heavy breathing fest, rather than actually being based in fact.
So this could be a Russians owned our pumps moment.
I am calling it a Russians owned our pump moment. I mean, I don't think that the certainly the balance of the evidence at the moment does not appear to be on Mr. Trevor Eckhart's side, eh? Like, and certainly Dan Rosenberg knows what he's on about and has spent a lot of time reversing Android stuff. And I would absolutely take his word.
Okay. Well, it also seems that this stuff is installed by default on iPhones as well, but it's quite easy to disable. Again, I mean, this is one of those things where we will know more in coming weeks, I guess, about what exactly is and isn't happening. But I guess, look, if they're not sending off that data to the carriers, then you could almost understand why this company, Carrier IQ, would be a little bit upset by a researcher making them out to be sinister.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, made claims about them using, you know, kind of rootkit style techniques, and I think that at the very least is pretty a bit far-fetched. Like, I watched the video, it doesn't look like a rootkit to me. It just looks like, you know, a daemon that's running on your phone, and the fact that it doesn't integrate nicely with the task management user interface, you know, right, that's, you know, pretty typical of any sort of embedded system. So I mean, I think probably that, you know, they would have helped themselves by not sending a cease and desist letter in the first place. But I mean, I think that when this comes out in the wash over the next couple of weeks, I think we will find that, you know, really Carrier IQ is collecting metrics for, you know, like handset usability stuff, and really isn't the kind of, you know, sinister, massive, you know, large scale spying ring that it's being made out to be in the media at the moment.
Alrighty. Well, moving on to a rather hilarious little bug. A bunch of researchers put out a HP bug, like a printer bug, where you could like reflash the device because it doesn't check for the, you know, doesn't check updates integrity. And they were saying that they could actually set printers on fire. But HP has come out and said, no, you can't.
Yeah, it made for really good reporting, didn't it? That, you know, hackers can actually turn your printer into a bomb. But no, so the apparently you can, you know, with Trojan firmware, cause the fuser assembly to get hotter than it's supposed to. HP have come out and said, actually, we have a thermal cutout that stops that from happening. And then the researchers who did the original stuff, apparently they, you know, caused the paper to turn brown, but the thermal cutout actually stopped the thing catching fire. So it got turned into, you know, hyperbole pretty quickly, I think. And I was under the impression that everyone knew about this whole, you know, you can reflash printers with print jobs thing. I didn't realize that was, you know, a new and interesting discovery. You know, HP have always done that, haven't they?
Well, it's funny that, because I had a few people saying, look, you know, there's vulnerable printers on corporate networks. You know, you guys going to cover this in the show? And it's, you know, it's something that's been known about for a very long time, is that these things are never maintained correctly. You know, we've seen news showing that a lot of these printers, scanners, photocopiers actually have a hard disk in them that winds up caching a lot of the documents as images. So if you can get in there, you can actually extract some valuable information. So I think printer security and photocopier security is something that has been covered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been on pen test jobs where, you know, we've owned the entire network through the printer because it was a printer in the DMZ, and you could pivot through it, bypass access controls, and off you go from there. And yeah, there's long stories of, you know, printers with embedded Linux systems or whatever, you know, hoarding documents for people to steal later on. So yeah, I'm not sure that there is any particularly new research to be done in the field of owning printers. And indeed, some of the printer vendors are, you know, are wising up to this. I mean, I've done product assessments for printer vendors, you know, assessing the security of their embedded platforms on printers. So, you know, it's, you know, and that was, you know, years ago now. So yeah, there's really nothing much new here, I wouldn't thought, apart from the, you know, reporting that it can catch on fire.
Now, in this next piece, in what looks to be a fairly ominous sign, CNET reports that a bunch of guys picked up in the Philippines for some fraudster sort of activity were actually being paid by a terrorist organization to engage in this activity to raise funds for the cause. You know, it doesn't look to be the most sophisticated sort of hacking that we would fear these guys would sort of engage, but it is perhaps a bit of a worrying sign.
Well, yeah, I guess it's something that people have been predicting for, you know, a long time, that we would start seeing, you know, terrorism and, you know, organized crime funding their operations through hacking for profit. And this particular set of hacks appears to be the group hacked into PBX systems, either at AT&T or AT&T customers or other telecommunications companies. It's a bit unclear from the report. And then were doing something that resulted in money being stolen up to a value of about $2 million. And I mean, it's not clear whether this is just regular, you know, long distance call fraud, whether, you know, reselling stolen access to call centers or whatever for profit, or whether they were using the intercepted phone calls for, you know, some other kind of profit making. So it's all very, very difficult to kind of judge the, you know, the level of technical sophistication or the level of targeting or exactly what, whether it really is just plain money raising. But yeah, it's something that has been predicted for a while, and I guess it's an interesting development to actually see it happening. But I mean, we see, you know, such a small percentage of things that get owned get reported, so it's very hard to judge whether this is a, you know, a genuine development or, you know, whether it's something that's just been going on the whole time anyway.
Yeah, certainly something that's going to be worth keeping an eye on, and we hope this isn't the beginning of a new trend, because obviously there is money to be made in this type of fraud, and obviously any organisation that is, well, organised, whether they be outlaw biker gangs, like, you know, we've got a big problem with them here in Australia, whether or not it's terrorist organisations, we really don't want organisations starting to approach this stuff, you know, organisations outside of the traditional online crime gangs sort of starting to use this as fundraising for other activities. Anyway, we're going to move on now to some more sophisticated stuff. A bit of Dooku news here. A bit of interesting news here saying that the people behind Dooku, as soon as the reports popped up in the press that about Dooku being discovered, all of their command and control boxes just got scorched, which is, you know, I mean, you're going to expect that. But what is interesting is just how close some of these CNC servers were to being imaged while they still had valuable information on them. I think in one case, they missed imaging this box by something like 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, the discussion that we've had about Dooku, about, you know, in terms of its sophistication and, you know, purported origin, and there's either, you know, kind of government, state-funded sort of thing, you know, you would expect them to have a plan for what happens when they get burnt and to be able to act on that plan fairly promptly. And so I guess, you know, the fact that that's happened probably shouldn't surprise people. But yeah, it's interesting how fine it was. And, you know, the guys who missed out on imaging that box by a couple of hours in India, man, they must have been so pissed off about that. But yeah, so there was a network of CNC boxes, which apparently were all owned compromised CentOS Linux boxes, which is pretty typical of mass hosting infrastructure, I suppose, were being used to proxy connections off towards the real CNC. So, you know, I don't know whether they actually managed to track back where that was heading, where the data was being proxied to, and whether that's turned up anything. But, you know, if you were a researcher working on this project, I guess you'd be very cagey about discussing anything in public now, you know, lest it gets scorched as well.
Yeah, missed it by that much, as Maxwell Smart used to say. Moving on to some business news now, and Moxie Marlinspike is in the money. His company Whisper Systems has been acquired by Twitter. Whisper Systems, of course, makes mobile security products, and Twitter apparently has purchased them.
This certainly took me by surprise, and I guess, you know, gathering by the response on Twitter itself, a bunch of other people as well. I mean, to start with, you know, who knew Twitter had any money, like, let alone a business model to support buying things? And B, you know, Moxie selling out, I guess, isn't exactly what we expected. I mean, you know, and obviously the guy has absolutely every right to go and, you know, sell his hard work and make some dough and stuff. But yeah, it's an interesting acquisition, and you got to wonder where it's going to head. Like, all of Whisper's products have been pulled whilst presumably they sort out exactly how it's going to work under Twitter ownership. And I haven't seen any, you know, statement about exactly where things are going from here. But yeah, a curious development. And one wonders if Moxie just got sick of, you know, actually having a job and wants to go back and, you know, sail around the Caribbean some more. Or, you know, whether it really is the beginning of, you know, more investment and better products and, you know, onwards from there. So, yeah, it certainly took me by surprise. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see exactly what comes out of it.
Well, who knows what the motivation is behind the deal and what the terms of the deal are and, you know, what that will actually do for Moxie's broader vision. So we just don't know. But, yeah, interesting development anyway. So maybe he'll be able to, you know, buy himself a very nice boat.
Yeah, exactly, instead of the, you know, the pestilence or whatever it was.
Now, very interesting story here from Krebs, Brian Krebs of Krebs on Security. Interesting little article about the an MO of some bad guys who are using DDoS attacks as part of a broader fraud campaign targeting, like, jewelry chains and stuff like this. Just a very nice little examination of a particular crime type here, Adam.
Yeah, so he's reporting that there's a bunch of criminals that are you know, breaking into banks through, you know, regular email Trojan spamming, wiring money out of the banks through jewelry stores so that the mules can pick up, you know, $100,000 worth of jewels or something, and then covering their tracks by actually DDoSing the bank and the bank's IT staff so that they can't actually you know, figure out what's going on, or they get too distracted dealing with the DDoS to really notice the fact that, you know, there's $100,000 transactions going out that probably ought to be, you know, reversed or something. But yeah, it's an interesting and I guess fairly logical development. I mean, it makes sense that you would use, you know, that kind of distraction to help cover your tracks a bit. You know, smart move by the Crims, and clearly it's working. So good for them, I guess.
Yeah, well, at least it's good for someone.
Although I'm not sure I really want to be Brian Krebs reporting on, you know, this kind of crime. I mean, you got to wonder how long before he gets, you know, roughed up like Dante Janchev.
Well, we did actually see a presentation by Alex Tilley of the Australian Federal Police in which he actually had a look at some of the death threats against Krebs, you know, who's made himself quite unpopular with some in the criminal underworld. Moving on now to a WikiLeaks-related story. WikiLeaks has dumped a whole bunch of documents pertaining to surveillance, the only problem being that they were kind of beaten to the punch on this one by the Wall Street Journal over a week ago, which makes me think that actually WikiLeaks these days can be regarded as a legitimate media organization because it's engaging in that time-old media practice that we engage in, of course, of rehashing stuff from other outlets. Good on you. It's a coming of age for WikiLeaks. They are a bona fide media organization.
And of course, it's especially funny that given we covered the story last week as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is that sort of thing, isn't it? It was like, hey, you know, we're relevant. I mean, maybe they were just holding on to their documents too long. Someone else got a hold of them, you know, got sick of waiting for WikiLeaks to actually release them. A lot of these documents were publicly available anyway. But yeah, it just seems a little, I don't know, a bit of an anticlimax, isn't it? When you're waiting on the next big release from WikiLeaks and it's something that was already pretty comprehensively covered by the Wall Street Journal and then subsequently by other media like, you know, us.
It's not, and it's certainly not to downplay the fact that this is interesting and useful information. You know, I have more documentation of exactly the sort of surveillance tools that are available and being used, you know, in law enforcement and in the military. I think it's very interesting, but yeah, it does make you question exactly how, you know, whether WikiLeaks can continue to stay relevant, you know, when they are being beaten to the punch by the likes of us.
Well, it wasn't us. I mean, full credit to the Wall Street Journal for actually putting in the resources into actually producing that piece and the online feature and the searchable archive and everything. That was very, very good work, you know. But moving on actually into another WikiLeaks-related piece, and this one, again, you know, this is just bad behaviour on the part of authorities. The civilian lawyer for Bradley Manning, the suspected source of much of WikiLeaks' most, you know, interesting information, their lawyer is trying to get a hold of internal government advice, which has basically been saying internally within the US government that the leak of all of the information that appeared on WikiLeaks was really no big thing. They're just like, you know, a lot of it was old, wasn't really a highly classified stuff. A lot of it was already known. The impact on the US government isn't going to be that severe, while publicly the US government is going out there saying that this was a terrible blow to national security and rah, 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 rah. So the government's kind of trying to have its cake and eat it too by saying publicly that Bradley Manning has caused untold damage to the US national interest, while internally they're saying, meh.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy, isn't it? Because I suppose all the people internally inside the government are, you know, trying to downplay it internally because they don't, you know, they're trying to cover their asses. They don't want to admit that either it was a big deal or maybe it honestly wasn't that much of a big deal. But yeah, having it both ways and then, you know, trying to, you know, pretend that it really was, you know, like a massive treasonous event and that, you know, Bradley Manning should be killed to death for it. When internally they are just covering their asses about it. You know, it does seem pretty disingenuous. And then to try and, you know, if Bradley Manning's lawyer is correctly, you know, and they are not being forthcoming with that kind of evidence that, you know, that they weren't that concerned about it. Yeah, that is pretty shitty. And, you know, I hope that, you know, the publicity that it does get, you know, moves that on a bit.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see as the trial gets into full swing what sort of public support Bradley Manning winds up behind him. Interesting times for sure. Now, we mentioned earlier Russians owning pumps. Man. Now there was this is the probably one of the best stories to cover all year. Actually, a couple of weeks ago there was a news report saying that a you know, SCADA linked pump at a water treatment facility in Illinois in the United States was owned by the Russians. And burned out, and it was like this first Stuxnet-like SCADA attack on the United States. You know, raise up to DEFCON 1. You know, get the scramble the FA-22s. You know, we're going to full alert. America under attack. Yeah, it turns out. And then of course, there was the Department of Homeland Security came out and said, look, no such thing actually happened. Kim Zetter of Wired has actually gone out and done the work to figure out what happened here. And, you know, you can't make this shit up. This is too funny.
It really is. It's f***ing hilarious is what this is. So apparently the pump blew up under, you know, like regular usage, because pumps do that sometimes. And the Russian hacker turned out to be this guy, Jim Mimlitz. from a company called Navionics Research, which actually set up the SCADA systems at the Illinois water treatment plant, who just happened to be, funnily enough, on holiday in Russia when he gets a phone call from the people who operate the system in Illinois, asking if he wouldn't mind terribly looking at some problem they were having. So he logs in from his hotel in Russia and checks it out and, logs out again. And that was the end of that. And apparently no one from the response center that was investigating this incident actually bothered to phone the guy whose login name was next to this login attempt, the log entry with an IP from Russia, to actually say, by the way, were you in Russia by any chance? Do you know anything about how your credentials might have got stolen if you weren't?
Now, where this gets really, really funny is that login occurred some 5 months, actually, before the pump failed. And there was no other evidence that he didn't even manipulate any systems. He was, looking at reports and things like that. Now, and the thing that I think makes it completely delicious is their entire case for attributing this to Russia was that the login came from a Russian IP address. I mean, way to go. What the hell?
Yeah, really. And if there isn't a better case for why all this discussion recently about kinetic responses to, cyber attacks on SCADA infrastructure is a f***ing awful idea, this story is absolute perfect case study.
Yes, luckily they managed to recall the nukes that were destined for Moscow,
Yeah, cancel the drone strike, was about to put a hellfire, through the Holiday Inn in Moscow. Man, there must be some real embarrassed people out there, but seriously, this is not good enough, right? It's absolutely ridiculous, and you guys are all a bunch of jerks.
And I think we need to turn Russians owned our pumps into the InfoSec equivalent of my dog ate it.
Yeah, exactly. me.
Now, look, I just want to cover this one real quick. The problems that organizations are having in terms of their exposure to vulnerabilities through Java are continuing. Rapid7 has actually added one of the more recent Java exploits into its framework because it's seen this bug sort of being distributed in the wild, and they're like, look, we're just adding it in there because we may as well give it to everyone to raise a bit of awareness. But, even Microsoft is jumping up and down and saying, look, most exploitation that we're seeing these days is actually occurring in the Java framework. So, what do you do? I mean, what do you do in an organization? It's a nightmare to manage. Many organizations, many enterprise apps actually require it. It just seems that this is a massive problem at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen boxes being popped through Java as the one of the most prevalent vectors, every year for the last 5 years. The whole story of Java, is write once, run anywhere, has been beset by, incompatible JVMs and incompatible applications and applications that are written for a specific version of the JVM. And so, so many enterprises which rely on enterprise software written in Java, are stuck in some cases on 3 or 4 year old versions of JVM already. And then let alone, when you patch up to the most recent one, you end up being vulnerable anyway. So, you really got to wonder, what the trade-off is, of actually using Java. Even the amount of security products. You buy a Cisco VPN appliance and you want to, SSL VPN into it or whatever, it drops a f***ing Java app onto you, which, it requires that you have Java installed and turn on your browser and gets you owned, right? And this is meant to be a security appliance. Jesus. And if I was Oracle and I'd bought Java, I mean, I suppose, Oracle hardly have a great track record, with their database product. But, they really did, buy a bit of a clanger there, I reckon, huh?
We're going to end this week's news with some non-InfoSec news, basically. I just wanted to have a look at recent developments in Iran. In the last few weeks, there's been two explosions at Iranian nuclear facilities, more or less claimed by Israel. We've also had an attack on the British embassy in Tehran, which has resulted in England withdrawing all of its diplomatic staff out of Iran and also expelling all Iranian diplomats from London. The EU, I saw EU Foreign Relations Commissioner or whatever from the EU basically this morning, extremely unhappy with Iran regarding that attack on the British embassy as being an attack on all of the European Union. So what we've seen is from Stuxnet, quite some time ago now, has then escalated into this. And I guess the reason that I thought this relevant and thought it would be a good thing to discuss on the show is because what Stuxnet did was effectively delay all of this drama by a couple of years. And that's, you know, really the jury's in, and it means that Stuxnet was a very positive thing in my mind.
Well, yeah, and I think that is a fairly reasonable conclusion to draw. I mean, at the discussion of the explosions in one of the nuclear facilities in Isfahan in Iran, like the Israelis, you know, have pretty much come out and said it was their fault, right? I mean, they've said, you know, that there aren't many coincidences, and you know, that there might be some sort of guiding hand, and that there are countries who impose sanctions, and that there are countries who do other things. You know, they're pretty much kind of taking responsibility for you know, blowing up some of this stuff pretty good, and you know that you know, in terms of attribution for Stuxnet, you know, really does sound like, you know, if they're willing to blow things up, they're certainly willing to Stuxnet things. And, you know, when the history of this particular period is written, you know, in 4 or 5 years or 10 years, whenever it actually comes out, I really would not be at all surprised to see, you know, actual outright attribution of Stuxnet. But, yeah, it's going to be an interesting, you know, an interesting story in the end to see exactly what effect Stuxnet had in terms of delaying, you know, this now, you know, much more kinetic escalation of the conflict. But yeah, no, it's very, very interesting. And if you look at the pictures of the site that got blown up earlier on in November, right? I mean, you really can't, you know, you can't look at that. I'm no satellite imagery analyst, but you know, that shit blew up real good. That ain't no accident, and it's certainly not a minor ammo dump explosion like the Iranian minister was information.
Yeah, it wasn't like claiming. It wasn't like the Coke vending machine popped a fuse. I think we can safely say that shit got blowed up good.
It did. It got blowed up real good.
All right, Adam, actually, that's it for this week's news. And that's actually it for this week's news. Now, I'm pretty much slipping off, you know, regular Risky Business duties for the next couple of months, but I reckon we should come back and maybe do a couple of news-only specials over the next couple of months. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be something interesting to discuss. And at the very least, we can badmouth some AV vendors, and we all do love that.
And we all do love that. And perhaps, you know, I can do my end from the from beside the swimming pool, because it is the southern summer, of course. I would say that you would do the same, but you live in New Zealand.
I do live in New Zealand. We can still drink a pina colada. It's just going to be cold and, you know, being hit by sideways rain while I'm doing it.
That's right. That's right. All right, Adam, thank you very much, mate. And we will chat to you again soon.
Cheers, dude. I look forward to it.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, this week we are speaking to Edith Cowan University lecturer Peter Hannay about how to use an Amazon Kindle ebook reader as a USB internet access device. You see, Amazon launched its Kindle readers with 3G access that's available anywhere that AT&T or Sprint have a roaming agreement. Now, the idea is if this thing is always connected, it'll be easy for people to buy ebooks whenever they want. So the 3G connection is essentially subsidized by Amazon's book sales operation. So yeah, you know, you can take your Kindle to Europe or Asia or wherever and buy your ebooks. That was the idea. Fantastic. Now, there were some restrictions on the device initially. I mean, you can actually use them to access the internet via Amazon's proxy, but internet access from the device's browser, while open in the USA, outside of the US, you could only use it to access Wikipedia and Amazon. But what if you wanted to use the Kindle as an actual USB internet access device? What if you wanted to SSH into your boxes from a completely free device anywhere in the world? Could it be done? And that's what got Peter thinking. He joined me by phone for this interview.
When I first saw them, the immediate thing that stood out to me was the claims of free 3G access. And certainly it was only in Australia for Wikipedia at the time and the Amazon store. Everything else was limited. But seeing that on there, at least seeing in the US, that it was able to access any website over their free 3G link, which I'm guessing someone pays a lot of money for. And the first thing that occurred to me is what else can be tunneled over this? How are they accomplishing it? Which partners are they dealing with? Because right now, if you look at it, there's a whole bunch of other companies doing the same thing. You've got people who are manufacture scales and alarm clocks and all this, and they're sort of on the same bandwagon of we'll buy 3G connections in bulk and have it feed back to our own servers over those 3G connections worldwide. But at the time, the Kindle was Amazon was the only company doing it, and the Kindle was the only device which was making use of that sort of idea.
So let me get this right. I buy a Kindle. I can use it to get to Wikipedia and, of course, to Amazon to buy ebooks, things like that. Say I buy one in Australia, I take it over to Europe. Will the connectivity still work over there?
Yeah.
So this is a device with always on, persistent 3G access that you can take and use anywhere in the world?
Yes, anywhere where there's an AT&T or Sprint roaming partner.
And you're thinking, wouldn't it be nice if we could view other websites?
Yeah, certainly other websites. And, I'm, of course, a bit of a nerd, so the idea of SSH and being able to access IRC from anywhere was certainly appealing. And I also do a lot of international traveling, and roaming data is really, really expensive. So if there's this company that's already decided to pay for roaming data, well, that's just great.
They've done it for you. It's pretty nice, and they got a nice big bulk discount.
Yeah.
So how did you go about actually stripping the thing down and working out, you know, how you could open up the device a little bit to allow you to really abuse Amazon?
Basically, I mean, I knew it was an embedded Linux device. That said pretty openly. They've got their GPL compliant stuff with some of the source code, so that's all there. So knowing it was Linux, the first goal was, of course, to get some sort of shell going, and just looking at the inputs and outputs into the device. So we've got 3G on it as one method of I/O. There's a USB connection, which by default maps only to mass storage, and there's the update mechanism, which seems to be the only way of getting executable code onto the device. And looking through this, their updates were in fact signed, but in a really unuseful way, at least for them. Basically, what they had was a tar archive. So when I was looking at their updates, it's just this tar.gz file with given some fancy extension. And when you unpack it, you've actually got all the files there along with a signature file.
So yeah, you basically had write access across the entire file system with tar, didn't you? So you'd actually just specified, you know, a new set of keys and just dropped them in over the old ones.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, it was untarring these things as root prior to checking the signatures and not cleaning up properly afterwards. It would clean up the temp directory where it expected you to put everything, but if you just specified other complete directory structures, it would just unpack them to wherever. So it was just a matter of telling it to dump the keys in the key store with your own dodgily generated keys.
Nice one. And then the package verifies and everything's great. I mean, how did you actually get the package onto the device in the first place, though?
Just through the mass storage interface. They plug it in via USB, dump the update in the root of the mass storage partition, and it'll run it.
What, you just put it there and it runs?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. That's very convenient. So I imagine, though, that, you know, once you've actually got access to the device, you know, you would have figured out what you would need to modify. Was there much reversing involved? Because, and also, how does actually modifying the device itself help you? Because I would have thought most of these restrictions would have been placed on the server end, not on the device side.
So there were a large number of server restrictions. Getting into the actual device is just the first port of call. So getting into the device, being able to drop our own keys on there is a good start because it lets us access some functions. And these are functions that were available in the early units. In the first units that Amazon shipped, there were a whole bunch of debug commands left in. You could just turn debug on and then issue a command called USB network. And that USB network command would just tell that USB port on there to, instead of acting like mass storage, to act like a Ethernet gadget. So from that point, you could just allocate yourself an IP and talk to the Kindle as if it was another machine on your network. And that led to getting shell. And, of course, they've got no root password on there because they're not expecting this to happen. And they learned their lesson pretty quickly. So the next versions they shipped didn't have this feature available. However, all the code, everything, everyone already had it. So it was just a matter of deploying that back onto the new devices and re-enabling these features.
I was just thinking you'd actually have basically an entire toolkit for that OS left over from the previous versions, right?
Yeah.
So you've got access to the device, you've got a shell. What were you limited by at that point?
Okay. At that point, it was figuring out how to get connectivity to the outside world. And certainly there's a 3G connection up. There's some sort of tunnel interface going. However, it's not as simple as it would be. You know, they do have their own server-side restrictions. There are only three IP addresses that I was able to find that you can actually access over that 3G connection. Two of them are their DNS servers, and those DNS servers will only resolve one address, and that's the address of their proxy server. And to be honest, this stuff I found managed through compiling TCP dump for the device and just sniffing out the traffic. So found these addresses that respond, and that proxy server dumped some more traffic. And from that, I was able to determine the specific header structure of the requests that go out to that proxy server. And it's extremely specific. Everything has to be in order. Everything has to be proper, even right down to the user agent and the way it does padding on the request. Everything has to be absolutely right. Their proxy server is very, very strict on what sort of requests it'll accept. And there's also one additional number in there, which is a per device hard-coded value that each device identifies to the proxy server with. So after finding that value, it's a matter of writing a new client for that proxy server that will authenticate properly.
Now, but I mean, once you're authenticated properly to it, it will still only allow you to go out to Wikipedia and Amazon, right?
That was certainly the case at the start. I mean, those restrictions are now completely gone, at least for devices registered in Australia. Prior to that, the solution was quite a simple one, and it's the same way people are getting around books not being available in Australia, which is simply changing their billing address to a United States address and not buying anything.
But hang on, I mean, previously you were not able to access websites at all. You were only allowed to access Wikipedia and Amazon. How did you actually get around that?
Oh, those restrictions are geographical in nature. Basically, it determines whether you're allowed to access Wikipedia and Amazon only, and that was a restriction placed on Australian and other international roaming countries. However, in the United States, they allowed access to any particular website. And if there was a United States Kindle roaming outside of the United States, they gave them that same level of access where they could access the wider internet.
So you basically, all you need to do is hack this thing, turn on the the Ethernet via USB, tell it it's American, tell the network it's American, and Bob's your mother's brother, you've got a roaming modem everywhere in the world.
Pretty much. You just have to do all that and pass it the magic per device key, which is easily extractable. It lives in Flash Opt. Yeah, and there you go. You can pretty much just connect out to any host. Standard sort of HTTPS connect tunneling, so throw it out over port 443, make sure you're other server, whatever it is listening on 443, and you're pretty much fine.
Are Australian Kindles still restricted, or can you just get one of these?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. So it still seems like a pretty good deal, because you don't really pay a subscriber's fee with these things, do you? You've just got this persistent free access.
No, it's actually an incredibly good deal. I'm not sure what it costs them, but and I'm sure it's subsidized by book sales and everything else, but yeah, it's incredibly a good and useful device, and I mean, that's what initially struck me about it, and inspired me to sort of tear it apart and see what I can do.
But yeah, I mean, it would be much handier, much, much handier to be able to use it as a modem to do stuff like SSH traffic. Is the reason that they haven't opened that stuff up just, do you think, to, you know, leave the device a little bit more opaque so people can't mess with copyright restrictions and stuff like that?
Honestly, I don't think so. There's very little in the way of DRM on there, aside from books that you buy from Amazon. If you've acquired books from other sources, whether they be legitimate or not, the device is more than happy to view them. The only thing it won't do is view someone else's purchased Amazon book if you just copy it across. So there's not really a lot in the way of copy protection on there. I don't think that's the problem. I think it was initial hesitation with whatever their roaming agreement was. For example, now they've started betaing the Kindle development kit, which I still haven't gotten access to, but I've read all the docs, and essentially any app developer will receive another key, and combined with that key and the local device key, they're allocated a certain amount of traffic per device per month to any server on any protocol after authenticating to the proxy again. So I think they're opening it up more and more as things progress, both in terms of possibly their contract rates coming down, or them trying to open the device up more to apps developers and sort of ride that bandwagon.
So by using some of the code that you yanked off earlier versions, this same approach will work on newer Kindles, like pretty much all models? Or
I can confirm it works on the called the Kindle keyboard now. It was the Kindle 3 before. I haven't been able to test it on the brand new devices, the Kindle Touch and I think they've just branded the other one just the Kindle.
Just to really clear that up and make everything...
make everything very easy to understand. So yeah. I haven't tested it on the two newest devices, or the Kindle Fire, but the Kindle Fire, to be honest, is just an Android tablet, so...
But you would imagine that this is likely to work, right?
Yeah. I imagine it's the same backend, it's the same infrastructure, so as long as there's per-device keys and as long as there's a proxy server, I don't see there being a problem.
So have people like turned this little approach into something that's easily scriptable, or is there like a little toolkit with the code in it that people can go grab and do this to their Kindle?
Yeah. Certainly when I started, it was a bit more work, but now there's a couple of guys who have worked together to make things very good. There's the Kindle packaging library, which provides the ability to just build update packages from scratch. There's the free Kindle library, which automates the approach of dumping a shared community set of keys on the device. Sort of, so there's a set of homebrew signing keys, and those are out there now. The USB network stuff's been thrown together in a nice, simple package. There's, again, packages to update screensavers and enable Unicode fonts and pretty much everything else. So it's become very, very easy to get sort of this level of access to the devices.
Excellent. Now, there is one drawback, though, which is speed, isn't it? They're quite slow.
Yeah, they're not incredibly fast. Yeah, we're looking at, it is a 3G link. There's some throttling going on somewhere. We're looking at dial-up speeds. At best, I've been able to achieve about 1.5 kilobytes a second. It is a slow connection. However, if you're just looking for an SSH terminal, it's just great.
Excellent. Well, Peter Hannay, thank you very much for joining us to discuss how to turn your Kindle into a free global SSH terminal.
You're welcome. It's been great talking to you.
Edith Cowan University lecturer Peter Hannay with a chat about the marvellous undocumented properties of Amazon's Kindle ebook reader there. And yeah, obviously it's not as simple as just, plugging it straight in. You need some server to proxy your connection. So if you want to check out Peter's proxy client code, you can go to openduck.com. That's openduck.com. And you'll find a post titled "Hooray for Reading Hacking the Kindle." And I'm sure if you Google for that, you'll find that as well. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Astaro's Senior Product Manager, Angelo Comazzetto. Angelo and I took a look back on the year that was 2011. Sure, there was the RSA breach, Lulzsec shenanigans, and anonymous operations, but Angelo reckons Sony was this year's star for all the wrong reasons.
There was also the massive Sony stuff as well. I mean, Sony being on our side of things, there was a lot of leverage and stuff that was gained out of security companies by saying, here's an example of what not to do. I mean, they're a big company and it affected their business. And if it can happen to them with all of their money and stuff, and this is like on a gaming network, how much could it affect you if you're not Sony? And so unfortunately, they're kind of the punching bag for everybody to use this year, I think, in terms of an example of why you need to have good security, especially around the web application stuff.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it was the most high-profile attack. It wasn't necessarily the most serious. I'd probably put RSA into the category of most serious high-profile attack. But the PSN network incident certainly did motivate some managers, didn't it?
Yeah, it's funny. That's a very good point that you make in that I really believe that the RSA has much, much stronger security ramifications. I mean, those types of products that were compromised are used for secure VPN tunnels to banks and access to protected systems. And it's funny that like a gaming network with some user information can be compromised. And it's interesting to me that the main focus of it wasn't so much of the data, or not so much of the personal data, like the names and information they put in there, but it was actually the credit card information that caused a lot of problems. Suddenly it was hundreds of thousands of credit card numbers were released into the wild. And I guess you could talk about who that really impacts the most. And I think that would be interesting to see as well as how the RSA stuff actually gets as a direct result of the RSA breach, if there's any really high profile stuff that ends up happening, if, you know, a power plant gets shut down somewhere, if there's any real security ramifications for that. I keep watching for some high profile ones, and I haven't really seen any direct result of RSA standing up on the front of the security postings yet.
Lockheed Martin comes to mind. I mean, that was one of them.
Yeah, they were breached, but did they actually disclose what they lost in terms of, did they say there's a whole bunch of plans for our next stealth fighter that was now somewhere else or something? Because that would be huge.
I think they're unlikely to come out and give you that sort of detail, you know. But certainly Lockheed were affected as a result of the RSA thing. What about mobile security? I mean, this year we've really seen malware popping along for the Android platform. You know, is this something that you believe is going to continue being a concern in 2012, or will it get worse?
I think it'll just get more important. I mean, mobile security is by far one of the biggest trends that we're seeing in terms of everybody has an idea of what they want. I mean, there's everyone's like, oh, I want to give a mobile to my people in my business, and I want to be able to have full control over it if they lose it. And I want to make sure that what's on there, as soon as you put company resources like email and stuff on there, it suddenly becomes a company concern. So there's always this paradigm of there's an internal fight, and we see it almost daily of people saying, this is my mobile, but I just want to check my work email on it. And then the work company says, well, if it's your personal mobile and you want work email, you have to do this, 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 and this. And it kind of creates this interesting problem where the businesses are choosing kind of between expensive solutions for mobile security, which may or may not work, not having the employees be as mobile on their personal devices, or just issuing them all official company devices, which are whether they're BlackBerries or Androids or iPhones. And I think those three arenas all have really good positives and negatives when it comes to security that is sometimes a fun discussion to have at this point.
So while we're talking predictions for next year, what are some of your big ones?
I think you're going to see mobile security and how you can control not even just mobiles, but roaming users and people who are in the field, and how you can somehow tie them into your main office collective intelligence in terms of enforcing web policies, encrypting devices, wiping devices. And I think that granular type of security all the way down to the employee is going to get very big. And whether they're using, like I said, a BlackBerry or an iPhone, there's always going to be different platforms that have different advantages, but it's really hot right now. I think almost everybody is asking about that, as well as the industry on the security in general is really interested in, not maybe so much for their own purposes, but everybody wants to know kind of what everybody else is doing about social networking stuff. But,
because the social networking thing has been a problem, you know, quote unquote problem for a number of years. I mean, what do you think will be the new aspect to it in 2012?
What you just said there is that quote unquote, you put it in quotes, right? Social networking is a problem. But when I ask businesses, what kind of problem do they have with Facebook? They're like, well, we're not really sure if we have a problem. Like, do we need to spend money to control that? Or is it just simple employee education? Or do we want to allow it in pieces and strip out the chat functions or the messaging functions of Facebook? I think that a big thing in 2012 is that people will start to figure out they need to do something, and different companies will take different positions. Because right now, a lot of companies have this. In the past, it was easy. You could say that I'm blocking Facebook because it's basically for posting pictures. And what happened is that a lot of companies started using Facebook to promote their own business. And so how do you use a medium to promote your business and then lock all your employees out from being able to see it at work, right? And so it creates an interesting kind of casual time-wasting use thing. Facebook is like the new solitaire. And it's become an interesting position to see how certain companies just say we block it totally, or some companies say we try to regulate it with certain devices. And other companies are just kind of, should we do something? Do we risk upsetting the herd of employees and making them unhappy?
So you think there's perhaps a recognition among in the enterprise now that Facebook isn't coming to destroy their productivity?
I think that a lot of them are concerned that it might, but at the same time, a lot of people think that Facebook and Twitter and social networking is a problem, but they're not sure, and they have absolutely no idea what they want to do about it. I mean, in an ideal world, they want employees working, and they still want to use all the social networkings to leverage their business if they can. And one of the interesting facts is, we've said for a long time that if an employee really doesn't want to work, he'll find ways not to work, right? Whether it's playing solitaire or reading the news or being on Facebook. And if you totally block Facebook at work, there's still nothing to prevent him from grabbing his own personal mobile and looking at Facebook on that. So, I mean, it's an interesting problem that I'm not really sure what the solution's going to be, but it's interesting that everybody wants to know kind of what the best practices are. Just, you know, if everybody's blocking Facebook, it's easier for us to say we're blocking Facebook, I guess.
Yeah, it's also like, you know, as you say, they can use their mobile devices or whatever, and the only difference being is now they're pissed off with management.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think you're going to be able to effectively control an employee's use of Facebook altogether, because there's nothing that stops somebody from going to the bathroom and taking their mobile phone with them and using 3G to look at Facebook if they really want to update their status and stuff that bad. But there's a lot of awareness that companies are looking for as well, because there's a lot of employees. Some companies are actually concerned not about what's happening on Facebook, but anytime you mix a lot of your close personal stuff with a lot of your business stuff, there's a chance that you don't understand the privacy settings or you let stuff overlap. And that's getting quite common. And I think a lot of companies are like, if you're the PR manager for a multi-thousand user company, maybe you don't want to mix all of your business contacts with what you're doing on the weekend, like, you know, drinking beer in a hot tub somewhere or something like that, and because that affects the company image. So I think that there's some very valid concerns about privacy controls and how to really separate the two when they're being used over the same medium like that.
All right. Well, Angelo Comizzato, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business for the final episode of 2011.
Thanks, Patrick. It was great being part of this.
It's been a long time since we've
Angelo Comizzetto of Astaro, the networking division of Sophos there. And that is it for this week's edition of Risky Business, and indeed for the 2011 season of the Risky Business podcast. Adam and I will likely pop in over the next couple of months, perhaps to do the odd standalone news segment. But on the whole, I'll be doing some non-risky business related work and trying to find some time to relax in the southern summer. This week's track is by one of my favourite pub bands from Melbourne many years ago. These guys were around in the mid-90s and they're called Curtis Late. They broke up like, I don't know, 10 years ago or something. I rescued this track off a cassette, so you'll even hear the hiss. So just imagine you're listening to a Walkman for a bit of nostalgia. And this track was never actually released. And these guys were sensational live. But if you are keen to hear more from this singer, she's done some solo stuff since. And her name is Kylie Aldist, and her new stuff is really awesome. I don't think it's actually on iTunes, but she has an EP out called Made of Stone. And you should be able to track that down somewhere. Go to her MySpace page or YouTube and have a listen and see if you like it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.